Lecture 43, Philip's Assassination and Legacy.
Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to finish looking at Macedonian imperialism under Philip in this lecture by taking his reign down to his assassination in 336. That means we'll discuss his settlement of the Greek states and their incorporation into the Macedonian Empire, his plan to invade the Persian Empire, his controversial seventh marriage that led to an open clash with Alexander, and the assassination itself. Then I want to make some concluding comments about his legacy that allowed Alexander to achieve what he did. The Battle of Chaeronea made Philip master of Greece, but that meant little unless he could somehow try to reconcile the Greeks to Macedonian rule. Philip knew that if he were to establish garrisons or pro-Macedonian oligarchies in all of the Greek states, this would have the opposite effect of keeping the Greeks passive, would backfire on him. Now you're probably thinking, ladies and gentlemen, that given the fierce independence of the Greeks and their attitude to foreigners, that Philip had as much chance of reconciling the Greeks to Macedonian rule as he had of walking on the moon. And I'd agree with you. But one thing we know about Philip by now is that he always had a trick or two up his sleeve. And he'd been thinking of his Greek settlement for quite some time now. Now, as we'll see, reconciling the Greeks to Macedonian hegemony doesn't mean Greeks living happily ever after under Macedonian rule. But if the exercise of power, that is, who pulled the strings, were masked in some way, that might be different. Before Philip could turn to a longer-term settlement of Greece, he had to deal with those states that had opposed him at Chaeronea. So after the dust from that battle had settled, Philip negotiated a series of individual settlements with those states. Now some of these states he treated harshly, others less so. For example, he dealt with the Thebans first, and he was very tough on them. Perhaps he dealt with them first because he still remembered his enforced stay in Thebes as a teenager, and the way that the Thebans had thumbed their noses at him right before Chaeronea. So what did he do with the Thebans? He installed a Macedonian oligarchy and garrison in Thebes. And as a result, a number of Theban democrats went into exile, and Theban hegemony of the Boeotian League was taken away. He also ordered the Thebans to pay a ransom for the corpses of those men who had died at Chaeronea, apart from the sacred band, and he sold those Thebans whom he'd taken prisoner at the battle as slaves. This, by the way, was common Greek practice. The Athenians, of course, were in a panic. They expected Philip to march on the city almost immediately. Demosthenes actually took to his heels. He used the excuse of gaining a commission to obtain corn from elsewhere as a pretext to get out of the city. We can understand this Athenian reaction given everything they'd done to thwart Philip really since the Peace of Philocrates in 346. However, Philip treated them leniently. The Athenians did have to dismantle their second Athenian naval confederacy, so that came to an end now. And we have echoes here then of the aftermath of their defeat in the Peloponnesian War when they had to dismantle the Delian League. But Philip didn't march into Attica as the Spartans had done back then. Athenian democracy was left untouched. No Macedonian garrison or oligarchy was set up in Athens, as the Spartans had done in 404, and no anti-Macedonian politicians like Demosthenes were ordered to be surrendered. What's more, Philip sent Alexander, no less, at the head of an official embassy to receive the Athenians' oath to a treaty of friendship and alliance that officially ended their second war against Philip. This was the one declared in 340 over Byzantium. In marked contrast to Philip's treatment of the Thebans, Alexander took back with him, took to Athens that is, the Athenian prisoners and the ashes of those who had died at Chaeronea, and no ransom was demanded. It's interesting, by the way, that Philip himself never went to Athens. Even though he was at war with the city for the lion's share of his reign, and even though he did have an honest appreciation of Athenian culture. In fact, Alexander only visited Athens once, and that was now in 338. Why Philip treated the Athenians so leniently is not fully known, though you might have guessed it, I've got a couple of suspicions. First, Athens would be a check on Thebes, which was still a substantial power in Greece. Second, there's the size and power of the Athenian navy. While Philip ordered the disbanding of the Second Athenian Naval Confederacy, he left the Athenian fleet alone. Philip was by now focusing on Asia for his next campaign. Remember what I said before about needing to keep the army on campaign? And for a campaign to Asia, he would need a fleet, the Athenian one. It made sense, therefore, to have the Athenians on side with him as far as possible, rather than completely against him or resenting him. And so his gesture of returning the Athenian dead and captives from Chaeronea would help there. He didn't need to do this. Philip then, that is, after these individual settlements with Thebes and Athens, headed to the Isthmus and then into the Peloponnese to deal with states there. He made alliances with a number of states in such a way that Sparta, which was always a troublemaker in the Peloponnese, was now hemmed in by a circle of states allied to Philip. At that point, Philip felt he could turn to the matter of absorbing Greece into his empire. So in the winter of 338, he summoned deputations from all of the Greek cities to meet him at Corinth. And there he announced his intention to bring about a common peace. Now, a common peace, as we said before, was a general agreement of all Greeks, whereby every state individually swore to ally with the others. That meant that if one were to break the terms of this common peace, for example, by waging war on another member state, then all of the other states could take action against it, could gang up against it. There had been common peaces before, like the King's Peace of 386 during the Spartan hegemony. We talked about this in a previous lecture. But this one of Philip's was utterly different. It was novel. First, unlike those in the past that had not held up for very long, Philip's common peace was an enforced one. He intended it to last, and it was going to last because of two main factors. Each state swore an oath of allegiance not to harm any other member of the common peace, nor to harm Philip and, significantly, his descendants. No member state could interfere in the domestic or foreign policy of another state. And no member state was to ally with any foreign power that might want to do harm to another state. Further, no state was to do anything that might lead to civil unrest or the overthrow of its constitution, such as unlawful exiles of people or confiscation of property. Second, there was to be an administrative machinery to this common peace that made it look like the Greeks still had a say in running Greece, as if they still had their autonomy. And that machinery was a council of the allies, under the direction of a hegemon, and each state would send a number of representatives to council meetings. Now the council would administer the league and deal with matters that affected it. In other words, all military, financial, domestic and foreign policy. And the council would also be the final arbiter in settling disputes. Macedonia was not a member of the council. And so was created what the Greeks called the community of the Greeks, to koinon Hellenon in the Greek, but which usually goes by the name that modern historians give it, the League of Corinth. Now, Philip knew his Greek history well, so do we by now. But Philip knew that an enforced common peace would be a deterrent for hostile action, given the xenophobic feelings that the Greeks had for each other. That's something that we've tracked throughout our entire course. In other words, if one state did rebel from the peace, or take hostile action against another state, or if it did something it wasn't supposed to do, like exile people, then the others would relish the chance to move legitimately against it. But he also knew that the Greeks cherished their freedom. Hence the reason for why he created this allied council, which on the surface seemed to be able to call the shots in Greece, so it looked like the Greeks still had a degree of their autonomy. The reality was very different, of course. And that's what made Philip's common peace brilliant and novel. Macedonia was not a member of this common peace, as I said, but given the power of Philip now, the Greeks had no choice but to elect him hegemon of the council. That's what he always intended anyway. His office of hegemon of the League of Corinth gave him all the power. We can make the analogy, I think, with the first Roman emperor, Augustus. Augustus allowed the Roman Senate to meet and to all intents and purposes, maintain the Republican Constitution. But this was a facade. In reality, he was pulling the strings behind the scenes. So also was Philip as hegemon of the League of Corinth. The Greeks might meet together in this council to discuss all issues affecting Greece, but look who was the hegemon of that council. Now, the deputations from the Greek states returned to their homes to announce Philip's plans. And these were endorsed because, let's face it, what choice did the Greeks have? These same deputations, these same embassies, returned to a second meeting at Corinth in the spring of 337. And it was at this meeting, this second one, that Philip was formally elected hegemon of the League. And it's at this meeting that he announced his grand plan to invade the Persian Empire. Now, we don't know when Philip first began to think about invading Asia. Diodorus says he first thought about doing so in 346, the same year as the Peace of Philocrates. Now, that's led some historians to believe that the Peace of Philocrates was something like an exit policy. So that the idea was that with this Greek settlement in place, Philip could now return to Macedonia and then leave for Asia. That's wrong. In fact, my former PhD advisor at Monash University had that view. So he and I used to get into lots of disputes. The reason why it's wrong is that Philip hadn't conquered Thrace. And he would need to conquer Thrace first to help secure his lines of communication. Moreover, that Peace of Philocrates blew up in Philip's face. It was never going to be a long-term settlement, the sort of settlement that was needed so that Philip could leave Greece behind and move to distant shores and not have to worry about the Greeks rebelling against him. The Peace of Philocrates was an interim measure, if you like. It was never meant to be an exit plan. The official reason for invading Asia was a Panhellenic one. That was A, to liberate the Greek cities of Asia Minor from Persian rule, and B, to seek revenge for what the Greeks, especially the Athenians, had suffered during the Persian Wars. Let's note once again how Philip is going out of his way to be nice to the Athenians. He wants to invade Asia on their behalf, looking for revenge for what they suffered in 480 BC. Again, I think this is a case of Philip knowing that with the Athenians on his side, the rest of the Greeks would be less inclined to query these pan-Hellenic motives for the campaign. And again, if I'm right here, then we see the influence of Athens on the mainland being emphasized one more time. Now, the real reasons, I mean, this pan-Hellenic reason, that's only the official one. That's not the real reason. The real reason may have had everything to do with Philip's need to keep his army on campaign. The revenge motive, to an extent with Philip, because the Persians helped Perinthus when Philip besieged it in 340. And finally, I think another real reason might be the need to acquire more revenue. Now, Persia was fabulously wealthy. Although the Macedonian king owned Macedonia's natural resources and huge tracts of land by virtue of his office, it's possible that Philip's cash reserves were limited. He had, after all, spent a vast amount of money on bribes and the like throughout his reign. Moreover, Philip practiced a rolling economy. He used one campaign to finance the next one. Now remember, he'd been bringing home a substantial amount of booty from Thrace and Scythia in 339, the horses, the women and children, which he could sell for profit. But then the Triballi had attacked him and seized everything. So that meant there was nothing to sell. So Philip may well have been hard-pressed financially in 338-337 and may have been looking to Asia to increase the amount of money in the Macedonian coffers. But Philip knew that the Greeks wouldn't care at all about his problems, so he made the Asian expedition a pan-Hellenic one, building in the revenge motive for the burning of Athens to appeal to the Athenians. After the spring meeting of the League of Corinth, Philip returned to Pella to plan for the Asian expedition. Later that same year, so we're still in 337, he married a teenage Macedonian girl named Cleopatra. This was his seventh marriage. Cleopatra was the adopted niece of a powerful Macedonian nobleman whose name was Attalus. Now the sources say that this was the only time that Philip did not marry for political reasons, as had been the case with his previous six wives. He married this time to Cleopatra out of love. That may well be true, but this marriage was virtually on the eve of his invasion of Asia. So here we go now with another view that I did warn you about a lecture or two ago. We can't fully discount a political reason for this marriage. Alexander was now 19 years old, and he was the next in line to the throne. But his elder brother Arrhidaeus was clearly out of that race. Philip may have wanted to father another son as he got ready to leave for Asia. And there was every chance that this might happen given Cleopatra's young age. She was only a teenager. Now, at the marriage feast, the feast to celebrate Philip and Cleopatra's marriage, Attalus, who is now Philip's father-in-law, toasted the couple, as we might expect. But then he insolently prayed that Macedonia might finally have a legitimate heir. Everyone present had been drinking heavily, and Alexander, who was furious that the comment insulted not only him, but also his mother, threw his drinking cup hard at Attalus's face and demanded an apology. Alexander's hissy fit, there I had to work in that fabulous expression somehow, what the Australians call chucking a wobbly, Alexander's hissy fit seems reasonable. But Philip, for some reason, sided with Attalus. He ordered Alexander to apologize to Attalus. And when Alexander refused, Philip drew his sword against his son, and he rushed at him. However, he fell over a table in a drunken stupor. Now, this prompted Alexander's comment, "Here is the man getting ready to cross from Europe to Asia, and he cannot even make it from one table to another." Alexander and Olympias then fled from court. They went to Epirus, where Olympias' brother Alexander was king. But Alexander, the son of Philip, soon after left Epirus to go to Illyria. Now, although there was a reconciliation of sorts between Philip and Alexander a short while later, and although Alexander returned to Pella at some point, as did Olympias, bad blood continued to exist between father and son. And this situation wasn't helped by Olympias, who hated Philip. She seems to have berated him to Alexander throughout his life. And it also didn't help that Attalus was appointed one of the commanders of the vanguard force that left for Asia, along with Parmenion and another general called Amyntas. This, by the way, is not the Amyntas who is the heir to the throne in 359. Now, in the spring of 336, this advance force, headed by Attalus, Parmenion, and Amyntas, left for Asia Minor. The plan was that Philip and the main army would join it that summer. Philip didn't leave immediately because taking place that summer at Agai was the marriage of his daughter by Olympias to Alexander, the king of Epirus. And the name of his daughter, just to complicate matters further, was Cleopatra. It's like doing French history. All French kings are Charles or Louis, so you're going to get it right eventually. So we've got two Cleopatras now and two Alexanders. Well, this marriage of Philip's daughter Cleopatra to the king of Epirus Alexander was a political one, in the sense that if Olympias had fled to Epirus to stir up trouble against Philip, then by making the king of Epirus his son-in-law, Philip neatly offset any potential threats from Epirus. This is clever, eh? But the marriage was also meant to be something of a media event to celebrate the power of Philip, the emergence, if you like, of the League of Corinth and the plan to invade Asia. And as such, this marriage was attended by many dignitaries from the Greek states, as well as members of the general public. It was like a royal wedding today. Now, the day after the marriage was turned over to celebratory games in the theatre at Agai. Now, remember, Agai is the traditional place for royal weddings and funerals. It was the capital before Pella, established by Archelaus. Now, these celebratory games started at dawn with a grand procession headed by large statues of the 12 Olympian gods, followed by a statue of Philip, that was as elaborately decked out as the others. Then Philip, dressed in white, walked into the theatre at Agai. He walked in either by himself or with his son Alexander and his new son-in-law Alexander of Epirus flanking him. The sources give both accounts. If these two men did accompany him, in other words, if Philip walked in flanked by the two Alexanders, they very quickly left him to take their seats because Philip next ordered the royal bodyguard back to show that he didn't need its protection. He apparently said that the goodwill of the Greeks would protect him. So Philip stood there in the middle of the theatre at Agai, facing the cheering crowd. And that's the last thing he heard, because suddenly one of the members of the royal bodyguard, Pausanias, rushed out and stabbed him. Philip died immediately or within minutes. He was 45. The official reason for the assassination, as put out by Alexander, was that Pausanias was an ex-lover of Philip's who had been unfairly treated by the king. Philip had dumped him for another man, and guess what? The other man's name was Pausanias. When Pausanias, the dumped lover, complained to Philip, he was ignored apparently. And so Pausanias, the dumped lover, who's the assassin of Philip, then complained to Attalus of all people. And apparently Attalus threw him out and condoned his stable hands in gang raping Pausanias. Now these men would have been slaves, so their rape of a free man was even more reprehensible. And apparently it was done with Attalus's consent. So we can see the personal reasons then for Pausanias assassinating the king. Jilted lover, hard done by, wants his revenge. There are problems with this version, though. For one thing, Pausanias was ditched a year or two earlier before he killed Philip. And why on earth was Attalus involved in all of this? The time for Pausanias' revenge would have been when he was jilted, not a year or two later, especially as by then, in 336, Attalus had gone with the advance force to Asia. He wasn't even present at Agai when this wedding took place and Philip was assassinated. Another problem is that the sources say Pausanias fled to waiting horses for his escape. Now, if he'd acted alone, he wouldn't need plural horses. The truth will probably never be known, as Pausanias was killed by the other members of the royal bodyguard within minutes. He was trying to flee the scene, he tripped over a vine or something, and the other members of the bodyguard javelined him to death. Another motive for the assassination is political, involving Olympias and perhaps even Alexander. This is the one I like. Olympias, as we said, already disliked Philip intensely. However, his seventh marriage to Cleopatra, and especially the implications of Attalus's prayer that Macedonia might finally have a legal heir, seem to have made her think, and perhaps made Alexander think too, that if Philip and Cleopatra did have a son, then maybe he would leapfrog over Alexander to become next in line to the throne. Now, this is nonsensical, as Alexander was clearly the heir apparent by now. But at the same time, it should be remembered that Olympias was not Macedonian, she was from Epirus, whereas Cleopatra was a full-blood Macedonian. That meant that any son born to her would be Macedonian, unlike Alexander. Now, if Philip were gadding around in Asia, or if he were to die over there, then Attalus, his father-in-law, who already disliked Alexander, might have been powerful enough to try to elevate his grandson over Alexander, Philip's son and heir. Moreover, relations between Philip and Alexander had deteriorated dramatically over the past couple of years, and the son's admiration of his father had turned to resentment. Eager for his own military glory, especially after his role at Chaeronea, Alexander was going to be denied that chance because Philip wasn't taking him to Asia. Alexander apparently used to say to his friends that while his father lived, there would be nothing great for him to achieve. And when Alexander visited the oracle of Zeus Ammon in Egypt, which we'll discuss in a lecture or two, one of the questions he asked was whether all of the murderers of his father had been punished. Now, this is an odd question, unless there was some suspicion of his involvement in the conspiracy. So Philip was dead, and Alexander became king. Philip was a charismatic king whose merits far outweigh his faults, in my opinion. And I'm going to end our lecture now with some comments on Philip's legacy. It's impossible to describe this legacy as anything but brilliant when you compare what Macedonia was like in 359, when Philip became king, to what it was like in 336 when he died. From a neo-feudal type of society, Macedonia became the first nation-state in Europe. Philip left Alexander a united Macedonia for the first time in its history, with an empire stretching from Greece to the Danube, a centralized monarchy, thriving urban centers, a formidable trained army and advances in siegecraft, the sort of army that opened the way for Alexander's great military successes. Philip left him no external threats to the kingdom, a strong economy, new incomes in the form of taxes and harbour dues and so on from the areas that Philip had conquered and annexed. He left Alexander the strongest coinage in Europe and general prosperity. All of this and more, however, was not just in marked contrast to the situation facing Philip in 359. It's also in marked contrast to the woeful legacy of Alexander the Great. It's time Philip comes out of the shadow of his more famous son and deservedly takes his place in the center of the stage of Greek history. The 4th century is usually called the Age of Alexander by modern historians. In my biography of Philip, remember every house should have one, I bring him into the limelight. I argue that the 4th century should be called the Age of Philip and Alexander. Now, in previous lectures, I've told you about figures that I believe have been underestimated, like Cleon and Philip II now. I've told you about figures that I think have been overestimated, like Pericles. Well, Alexander is also someone that I believe has been overestimated. Yes, he was a brilliant general and strategist, but he wasn't just a general, he was a king. And when I discuss him in this light in the next lectures, a very different Alexander emerges. And as we'll see, it's a very different Greece, especially Athens, during the reign of Alexander from that of Philip. Even though Alexander was in Greece for only the first 2 years of his reign. So in our next lecture, ladies and gentlemen, we'll deal with those first 2 years of Alexander's reign to show how he could keep Greece cowed even after he left it and went as far afield as India, what is today the modern Pakistan. Thank you so much.